You're listening to Truly Criminal, the home of true crime. To see the video version of this case, including the footage and photos, you can find us on YouTube. Just search for Truly Criminal. Today's case is being done in collaboration with Naomi Channel from The Real Podcast. Naomi is an award-winning television producer, and for anyone who is interested in true crime, her podcast is one to listen to. Every story she covers is treated with respect and empathy for those involved, and she is always on a search for the truth. So, if you want to listen to a deep dive on this case, complete with interviews from various people connected with it, please go and listen to Real. We have also left a link to her podcast in the description box.
It was a crime that shocked us all. A 13-year-old girl battered to death on her doorstep and in broad daylight.
For many years, Hastings on the Sussex coast in the south of England had been seen as a great place for a nice getaway or somewhere to move to for a new start. It's close to the sea with plenty of fascinating history to enjoy. There's gorgeous parks and lovely local shops. This is where our story begins, one Saturday afternoon in February 1997. On Lower Park Road lived the Jenkins family. Father Sean, Mother Lois and their children, Charlotte, Annie, Maya, Esther and Billy Jo, who was their foster daughter. On the 15th of February 1997, it was the end of the February half term, where children enjoy a week off school. It was an unusually hot day, and many were out in Alexandra Park enjoying the sunshine. Alexandra Park is located directly opposite Lower Park Road, and it is often busy with families, dog walkers and joggers. That day, Billy Jo was in the garden painting the back patio doors. Annie was at home too, along with Sean. Lois had taken Maya and Esther for a walk with their dog, and Charlotte was at a clarinet lesson. Lois had taken the youngest girls for a walk after having an argument with Billy Jo over a pair of trainers she told Billy Jo she couldn't have. Billy Jo's best friend Holly had offered to go round and help her paint the doors, but Sean told her she couldn't, as Billy Jo was due to be seeing her biological father that weekend, so it wouldn't be possible for her to go over. Billy Jo and Holly spent loads of time with each other and went to Helenswood School together too. They loved hanging out and listening to their favourite E17 songs. The day continued to pass by and it was soon time for Sean to go and collect Charlotte and one of Charlotte's friends from their music lesson. He set off with Annie and Billy Jo stayed behind on her own in the garden to carry on painting and listening to music. After dropping Charlotte's friend off, they headed back to Lower Park Road, and Charlotte ran inside and upstairs to put her clarinet away. When she came back down, Sean said they needed to go out again to get some white spirit to remove some paint splashes that Billy Jo had made. They set off in his car to a DIY store, but before they made it there, Sean realised he didn't have any money with him, so they headed home. After getting back to the house at 3:30 p.m, Charlotte had gone inside, and at the back of the property, she came across a traumatising scene. 13-year-old Billy Jo was lying on the patio with the left side of her face to the ground and blood all around her. She was still holding the paintbrush. She screamed and called for her dad, who came running, and then ushered his daughters into the playroom away from her body. He called his neighbour and family friend, Denise Lancaster, asking for her help. Denise immediately went over. She said Billy Jo's skull was shattered and that she was so badly injured she didn't even want to touch her, telling Sean to ring for an ambulance. She described Billy Jo's head as being on a bin liner, and part of the bin liner was deep inside her left nostril.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller. Where do you need the ambulance?
48 Lower Park Road.
Lower Park Road.
Lower Park Road, Hastings, and it is an emergency.
And what's happened there?
I don't know. My daughter's fallen or she's got head injuries. There's blood everywhere.
Well, she's banged her head and bleeding from the head.
Yes, well, I don't know. She says blood everywhere on her head. She's lying on the floor.
And can I take your name, sir?
Sean Jenkins.
Emergency services quickly descended on the scene, and the quiet residential street was soon full of police and paramedics. A police surgeon who attended the scene said it was one of the worst cases he had ever seen in his career. "I have 26 years of experience of being a police surgeon, and this is without doubt the saddest and most brutal murder I have ever attended," he said. While chaos was unfolding on Lower Park Road, Lois was completely none the wiser. The weather was beautiful, and so wondering if the rest of the family wanted to come out and enjoy the sun, she phoned home. Sean picked up the phone and said, "Billy's had an accident." She raced back home where she was met by a police officer who had tears in his eyes. He led Lois back into the house. Billy Joe had been bludgeoned to death with an 18-inch iron tent peg that had come from the shed located at the bottom of the garden. The tent peg had been put on the bunker of the patio earlier that day by one of the other children. She had not been the victim of a sexual assault, and there was no evidence to suggest a break-in. Who on earth would murder a 13-year-old girl in the back garden of her own home in the middle of the day when people were out and about?
Billy Joe was attacked with a tent spike as she painted a back door, left alone for just 40 minutes as the rest of the family went shopping.
As the investigation got underway and lines of inquiry were being followed, Sean provided the police with some disturbing information. He said that roughly 2 weeks before Billy Joe's death, he had found a man in their back garden, and 2 weeks prior to that, he had also seen a man staring at the house from across the street in Alexandra Park. The family had found the side gate open several times and had become so concerned by this man, security lighting was installed at the property and locks were added to the windows. The previous year, locals had become so concerned with safety in the park after reports of men exposing themselves and drug deals taking place that 1,000 people signed a petition arguing for security in the park to be increased. The house next door to the Jenkins family was abandoned and had been boarded up to protect it from vandalism, which was also becoming a big problem in the area alongside robberies, and police said they were looking at a new theory. Had Billy Joe's killer been hiding in the house next door and waiting for the perfect moment to strike? Billy Joe had even said that she was worried she had been followed by someone since December, telling her friends that a white man in a leather jacket in his 40s or 50s had been following her. This description matched the man that Sean said had been watching the house from Alexandra Park. This was not the only time this had happened. Two years before, Billy Joe had said she was worried she was being stalked by someone, and both her school and the police were made aware of the situation. She had received several cold calls from someone who told her she was being watched. Lois was aware of the phone calls, but believed that the person on the other end had not spoken. Detective Superintendent Jeremy Payne said she had told her parents and friends she felt she was being followed and had spotted a man on some occasions. It appears that she felt this man was paying particular attention to her for some reason. By late 1996, Sean and Lois were considering moving home. This must have been incredibly difficult for Billy Joe. She had already been through a lot in her short life. Billy Joe Margaret Jenkins was born on March 29, 1983, in East London to parents Deborah and Bill Jenkins. At the age of 9, Billy Joe was placed in foster care as her mother had not been able to cope and her father had gone to prison. Her mother said she had placed her children in foster care due to her husband's violence. It was in a newspaper advert in 1992 that Sean and Lois Jenkins, who coincidentally shared the same surname, answered the call for foster parents. Newham Social Services visited and placed a 9-year-old girl with them, Billy Joe Jenkins, and her 13-year-old brother Daryl. Daryl left the foster family a few months later, but Billy Joe stayed. Sean worked in education and Lois was a social worker, so it seemed to be a great fit for Billy Joe. In 1993, they moved to Hastings from London after Sean got a job at William Parker School for Boys, and they settled into a house on Lower Park Road. The stability and security seemed to be perfect for Billy Joe. Lois and Sean had met at a charity event in London in 1982 while he was working as a supply teacher, and they married in Dorset in December the same year. 2 years later, they welcomed their first daughter and then had three more in 1986, 1988 and 1989. After being with the family for several years, Sean and Lois eventually became her legal guardians. It wasn't always easy for Billy Joe or her foster family. Foster care can be an unsettling and traumatic experience for many children, and these complexities often require deep empathy, patience, and understanding on behalf of those who care for them. But Billie Jo was still a bright and lively young girl who worked hard and was well liked amongst her peers. As one of her neighbours later said, Billie Jo was a young lady in the old-fashioned sense of the word. It was rare to meet a young girl with such manners. It was a life that was so full of promise and hope, a life that had been cruelly and violently snatched away in a shocking act of brutality. A post-mortem was carried out and it was discovered that in the ferocity of the attack, her skull had been split. She had been attacked from behind and hit at least 5 times. Whoever had done this was clearly a dangerous offender, and the police needed to bring them to justice. One person the police were looking at was a local man known only as Mr. B. He was described as a white man, 5'10", with fair hair and some sort of scar or birthmark on his face. He was seen carrying a baguette and a plastic bag from the shop Safeway. While the investigation continued, the police knew they needed more. So, on the 18th of February, the police asked Sean to appeal to the public for any information relating to the case. Lois appeared with him and struggled to contain her devastation. Sean read the following prepared statement. "As a family, we are totally devastated. We do not understand why or what the motive was, but we are working closely with the police in the hope that the killer will be found and that we can eventually piece our lives back together over the coming years. As parents, our sadness drives us to work closely with the police to find her killer. We therefore appeal to anyone who thinks they have any information about this crime to contact the police." He also spoke about the alleged prowlers in the area. "As a family, we have felt uneasy about prowlers. On one occasion, I was looking out of the back window and I thought I saw movement. I switched on the security light and got a fleeting glimpse of somebody moving about. Another time, I saw somebody in the park staring at the house." Sean and Lois's daughter Charlotte also told the police that when they had left to go to the DIY shop, the back gate was closed. When they returned, she said it was open. 9 days later, an arrest was made. A man was taken into custody, and he had even tried to strangle the arresting officer. It was Mr. B. On the day of Billie Jo's murder, Mr. B had what was referred to as a rather confused conversation with someone who owned a nearby guest house. He had rang the bell and asked for accommodation, and the owner said it was clear that this man had mental health issues and suggested he would be able to find accommodation in the town centre. The route that he pointed him in would have meant he walked past the Jenkins home. His behaviour in custody also caused great concern. At one point, he was found in a fetal position with part of a plastic bag shoved into one of his nostrils, as he believed he had to block the body openings to stop germs from getting in. When Billie Jo was found, part of a plastic bin bag had been lodged in one of her nostrils. More plastic was also found in his underwear. However, he was soon released from custody and into secure psychiatric care, and was ruled out as several witnesses had placed him at least 15 minutes away from the house on Lower Park Road. There was also no forensic evidence to link him to the crime. Another man was arrested a few days later, but he too was ruled out and released. Soon there would be a development that would leave people stunned. Sean Jenkins was arrested and taken into custody on suspicion of murdering his foster daughter. He was adamant that he had nothing to do with it, but 3 weeks later, he was charged with murder and dishonestly obtaining a pecuniary advantage. After looking into his background, it was revealed that he had not been truthful about his teaching experience or his qualifications in order to secure a job of deputy headmaster at William Parker School. He had said that he had attended the prestigious private Gordonston School and that he had 10 O-levels at Grade A, when in actual fact he had C's and below. He said he had gone to the University of Kent and graduated with a 2-1 in English, and then got his postgraduate teaching qualification in English with drama. This was also not true. He had just studied to become a teacher with PE as his subject. He said he had gained a Master's in Education Management from the University of London. He actually did have that degree, but it was from the University of East London. To the police, this was evidence that Sean Jenkins was an accomplished liar. As they continued to look into him, there would be yet another twist. 3 weeks after the murder of Billy Joe, a woman walked into Hastings Police Station and told them her story. Lois Jenkins. On the face of it, this appeared to be a very happy family, but talking to Lois and the children painted a very different picture of Sean. When looking at what had happened that day in the lead-up to the murder, tension between Annie and Billy Joe was examined. The police notes read, "Lois believes that Sean loved them both, but has a theory that if Sean lost it on Saturday, it would have been around this. Billy smugly painting something Annie desperately wanted to do. Winding Annie up, confirmed by Annie. Annie hangdog and depressed, washing the opal car. Sean suddenly thinking, what am I doing? Why am I allowing this to happen? A gesture from Billy to Annie to rub at him further, as she was prone to do. It was enough to make Sean snap. It wasn't just his CV that came under scrutiny. Prior to the murder, Sean had decided he wanted to venture into politics and join the Conservative Party, despite his left-wing views. And it was during this time that Lois said he began to lie, which caused arguments between the two of them. She said he wrote a small manifesto about himself, which I knew to be inaccurate. He said he was a regular theatre-goer, yet we hadn't been to a theatre performance for 6 years. We argued endlessly about his strange behaviour. It wasn't just arguments that were causing a problem, but violence too, according to Lois. She said, I think he felt insecure. I never thought his behaviour was normal, but I got used to it. I ended up feeling very sorry for him, as I felt he was a victim of emotions that he couldn't control. She also was worried about the discipline he was using on the children. There was a book that was popular at the church they attended called Dare to Discipline, and after attending a series of talks by James Dobson, the author of said book, Sean had started to use a stick in corporal punishment at home. Lois said Sean would use a stick or a slipper. If I challenged Sean's discipline, he would lose his temper, and sometimes he threatened me. She said that the violence had started before they were even married, with the first instance being 3 weeks before their wedding day. He lost his temper and slapped me around my face, she told police. A few weeks after the marriage, he had a violent outburst and slapped me again. I was surprised at how volatile he was and felt frightened. When he lost his temper, he never shouted. He would just lose it, snap, and in a few moments he would be back to normal. She said his violence continued to escalate. When we lived in East Ham, Sean hit me one night and pulled my hair, which was long then. It was the first time I was really frightened of him. I told him I was not going to put up with it anymore. For the first time, he admitted he had a temper. Previously, he had always blanked it out and refused to admit that he had hit me. She didn't tell social services any of this when they came to place Billy Joe with them. Billy Joe was now gone, and the spotlight was firmly on Sean Jenkins. Sean told police that after returning home, he had gone into the dining room to turn the music down and said that there was no reaction from Billy Joe. He described the moment he found her. I felt her neck. I moved the hair off the side of her face. I then became aware that her forehead appeared to be different, misshapen. I also saw that her eye was swollen, as if someone had punched her. I then noticed a bubble from her nose, and I believed that she was alive at that moment. I also noticed that I had blood on my hands. I felt sick. On the day of the murder, Sean had been wearing a blue fleece, trousers and shoes. When his clothes were examined, they were found to have more than 100 tiny blood spots on them. The exact amount does differ depending on the source. And it was argued that these had come from him attacking her, also known as impact spatter. The case that was presented was that after returning from picking Charlotte up, he had bludgeoned Billy Joe in a fit of rage, and then hurried out of the house to the DIY store to give himself an alibi, being sure to drive an extra long, unnecessarily long route. The time frame of him getting home and then leaving again was about 3 minutes. Sean said that this version of events was not true and he was not responsible for her death. There were several aspects of Sean's behaviour which had struck the investigators as strange. They had gone to go and buy white spirit, but there later turned out to already be some in the house. Also, after finding Billy Joe, Sean left his children with the neighbour and went and sat in his car. He later said that he realised as he was sat there that it was a stupid thing to do, so proceeded to get out. With the forensics of the blood spots and the belief that they could only have got onto his clothes from the impact of the attack, the police formally charged him with murder on the 14th of March. Tuesday, the 22nd of April, 1997. Billy Joe's funeral service was held at a chapel in East London. A horse-drawn carriage transported her coffin, and behind it walked nearly 300 people, holding on to each other for support and comfort. Many people had travelled from Hastings to be there. Just before the service was due to start, Lois arrived with her four daughters, and Billy Joe's mother, Deborah, froze. She had specifically asked her to stay away from the service. Deborah then ran out of the service in tears, followed by her partner. They drove away and missed both the service and the burial. Sean was on bail at the time, but did not go to the funeral. June 1998. It was now time for Sean Jenkins to go on trial, and the media interest in the trial would be huge. During his trial, it was put forward by the prosecution that Sean had murdered Billy Joe after frustrating and irritating events during the day, but they added that the real motive behind the killing might never come to light. The prosecution argued that there was a small time frame when he was alone in the house with Billy Joe, as his daughters waited for him outside. They said that it was in this time frame that he flew into a rage, attacking her with a tent peg, before going back out to the front of the house and setting off to the DIY store. His daughter told the court that the route he had driven was weird. He had left Lower Park Road and turned onto Bethune Way, then onto St Helens Road, and finally Dordrecht Way, and back onto Lower Park Road, looping the park twice, before finally going in the direction of the DIY shop. At the traffic lights by the Sainsbury's on Suddlescombe Road North, he realised he hadn't brought any money with him, so they turned around and drove back empty-handed. This journey totaled around 15 minutes. It was argued he had taken this route and decided to go to the shop to provide himself with an alibi. The case relied heavily upon the blood spots and the belief that they had come from the murder. But the defence hit back at this and said that they had got onto his clothes when he found her and moved her. They said air was released from her lungs as she was moved, thus spraying him with tiny fine blood spots. The defence also presented an experiment to the court to show that this could have been how the blood spots got onto his clothes. Dr. Ian Hill, a pathologist, was called by the prosecution to offer his opinion on said experiment. He called the experiment quite unrealistic, because the amount of air they used was more than an adult breathing would use, and he added that there was only a blockage in her lower airway. It was later revealed that the blockage had actually been in her upper airway. The blood spots were also looked at under an electron microscope by Dr. Jeremy Skepper of Cambridge University. He said that the blood spots contained white particles that could have been damaged skin tissue from her head. The claims that they had got there from Billy Joe's breathing were labelled as impossible by an expert witness. Professor David Southall from Keele University said that he had no doubt that he regarded it as impossible, given the level and nature of the injuries she had. He said that it was highly unlikely that Billy Joe could have inhaled the 2.2 litres of air necessary for her to exhale forcefully enough for the blood to spatter. I still doubt whether she would have been able to inhale 2.2 litres with a gasp, but I accept that at the very worst, she might have been able to. It is very unlikely, but I can't say it couldn't possibly happen. I am talking way out on the extremes of what could happen in extreme situations, he said. He said that gasping like that would have been extremely visible, and that he had seen nothing in Sean's statement that mentioned her gasping. Another forensic expert seconded this opinion. The nature and the distribution of the bloodstains on Mr. Jenkins' clothing was entirely consistent with the results of the wearer of the clothing having delivered several blows onto wet blood and the clothing having intercepted an impact mist of the blood as a result. It was noted that neither Denise, who had gone to Billy Joe after Sean had called for her help, nor the paramedics had similar blood spots on them. The Home Office pathologist, Dr. Ian Hill, had been the person to carry out the post-mortem on Billy Joe. He said that the bruises and cuts to her hands and arms were consistent with her trying to defend herself from the onslaught. Billy Joe's biological mother left the courtroom in tears after a video of the police examining her daughter's body was played. Billy Joe's biological father also left the public gallery. Jury members were also left very upset, and those sat in the public gallery gasped at the video. Sean was given special permission to leave the dock while it played. The video showed Billy Joe as she lay on her back, blood soaked into her white shirt, and her awful head injury visible. It was now time for Sean to give evidence. He said that he had panicked when he found her body and explained that he went to call for an ambulance, but as he did, the phone had started to ring. He said he picked up the phone and slammed it down to stop it. "I didn't want to speak to anyone, I just panicked," he said. When asked how he helped Billie Jo, he told the court, "I went down to her and whispered to her gently, and I don't know what I did next." He was asked by the prosecutor why he chose to use that phone and not the one close to her body. He replied, "Because the girls were screaming and screeching and crying, and I wanted to be near them. I wasn't sure whether there was somebody else in the house and I didn't want to leave the girls. I didn't make a rational decision." Why, when the emergency services had asked him to, did he not put her in the recovery position? "I'm not even sure I knew what the recovery position was. When I saw Billy, I was stunned, and I didn't know what to do and I panicked." The prosecutor responded, "There was no point in the recovery position because you knew Billie Jo was dead. That's just wrong," Sean replied. When looking at his behaviour after the murder, the prosecution said that him being slow to call for the ambulance and the claims that he went to his car to put the soft top up over worries about its security were indications of guilt, but a neurologist said that these could have been the response to being in shock. The topic of whether or not to call the children as witnesses became a big issue. Lois told the police that their children had since changed their stories, which had previously backed up Sean's version of events, and suggested that he would not have had the time to kill Billie Jo before leaving to go to the DIY store. She said that they had now turned against him and could no longer be called as witnesses. There was also a statement from Annie, which was not put before the court. It alleged that her father had once punched her in the stomach with such force she had needed to lie down. The police had asked her about the physical punishments meted out by her father, and she replied, "But doesn't every family have a naughty stick?" The jury also did not hear Lois's testimony, as she did not appear for either the prosecution or the defence. The trial would last for 19 days and 15 witnesses would be called, including psychiatrists and forensic experts. The jury would deliberate for 2 days, and on the second day the judge told them he would accept a majority verdict of 10-2. They then came back with a unanimous one. Sean Jenkins was convicted of the murder of Billie Jo and sentenced to life in prison. The guilty verdict prompted shouts of yes from the public gallery. Mr. Justice Gage told him that he had been convicted on the back of what he called compelling evidence. "By any standards, this is a horrendous crime. The fact you committed this crime, the circumstances in which it was committed, and the way in which it was committed, lead me to conclude that you are a very considerable danger to the community. There is only one sentence. You'll be sentenced to the equivalent of life."
Deputy Head gets life for Billie Jo's murder.
The facade of respectability. Sean Jenkins, the deputy headmaster, tonight beginning a life sentence for the ferocious murder of his foster daughter.
Lois Jenkins filed for divorce and took their children and moved to Australia, where she would later remarry and have a son. She said in a statement, 16 months ago I returned with two of my children from a quiet Saturday afternoon walk on the beach to a tragedy more horrific than any person ever expects to encounter in a lifetime. It is a terrible thing to realise that the man with whom you have lived for 14 years, the father of your children, is capable of murdering your child. There is no reason, no explanation for such a pointless waste of a young life. Now that the trial is over, the girls and I need peace and quiet to come to terms with what has happened. In 1999, Sean lodged an appeal against his conviction. He argued that the forensic evidence that had been presented was inaccurate. He lost this appeal on December 21st. But that is not the end of the story. In 2002, the Criminal Case Review Commission, which investigates suspected miscarriages of justice, commissioned Kent Police to re-interview Annie and Charlotte in Tasmania. They had both suggested they could not recall making the comments their mother had attributed to them. The 12th of May 2003. The Criminal Cases Review Commission had been looking into the case now for 2 years, and it was subsequently moved back to the Court of Appeal. The Criminal Cases Review Commission said that the jury had not heard evidence from Sean's daughters, who had corroborated what he had said. His appeal began on the 30th of June 2004. After flying in from Tasmania, where she now lived with her mother and siblings, Charlotte gave evidence at the appeal. Sean's lawyers argued that if Charlotte and Annie had been allowed to testify during the first trial, they could have corroborated his story. They also said that Lois had lied to the police when she said that they had changed their stories against him. During Charlotte's evidence, she said that she had been worried about incriminating her father and that he might not ever like her again if she did so. She told the court that it was a possibility that she had said to Lois that she knew Sean was responsible for Billy Joe's murder. She didn't contradict what her mother had said, but admitted that her memories were hazy. When talking about the day of Billy Joe's murder, she said that she had remembered having her clarinet lesson and being picked up by Sean before he drove both her and Annie home. While Charlotte was not asked about how long they spent at the house, the defense asked her to talk about what she could remember. She said she remembered going quickly up to her bedroom to put her clarinet away, and that they soon left to go to the DIY shop. What follows is a transcript of the questions and answers between Charlotte and Sean's defense lawyer, Claire Montgomery QC, who asked who was the first to enter the house. "I think it was me." "Where did you go?" "Into the dining room." "We know you saw Billy Joe." Charlotte then began to cry and nod. She asked for a break and left the courtroom, and after having a breather, she came back to continue her evidence. The lawyer asked her about conversations Lois said she had had with her daughter that dissuaded the defense team from the first trial calling the children as witnesses. She asked if Charlotte had told Lois that she was worried about incriminating Sean. Charlotte said, "I vaguely remember being worried about it, but I can't remember the conversation." "Did Charlotte tell Lois that she just knew Sean had murdered Billy Joe?" Charlotte responded, "I may have because I was confused and kept changing my mind. I can't remember, I was confused remembering the day, wondering whether or not to believe what was in the papers, things like that." "Had you believed your father was guilty?" "I can't remember." "What made you think he was guilty? What was being said to you?" "I can't remember thinking it, so I don't understand why you're asking." She also denied that Lois had coached her and turned her against her father. She added that at no time had he coached her on what to say or asked her about her story. The prosecutor had planned for a lengthy cross-examination, but after hearing Charlotte's evidence, chose not to ask any questions. Annie had declined to come back to the UK from Tasmania, saying it would disrupt her studies, and she had only just started to settle there. She did give a video interview, and extracts of the interview were read to the court. She said that she didn't remember some of the conversations Lois had spoken to the police about. She spoke about occasions where Sean allegedly exhibited violence towards them, saying he had punched her in the stomach and also kicked Billy Joe. She said she couldn't remember an alleged incident in which he reportedly dragged their sister Maya up two flights of stairs by her ears. Lois did testify against Sean during his appeal and described him as going into violent rages, with one such incident leaving her with a perforated eardrum. 2 years after they had moved to the coast, Lois said an attack from Sean had left her needing hospital treatment. "He hit me around the face hard and my head was spinning with the force of it. I went upstairs and hid in the loft, crying. Later I went downstairs and it was as if Sean had forgotten." Sean's lawyer said that Lois had become sure that he was responsible for Billy Joe's murder and worried that Charlotte and Annie's original statements could provide him with an alibi, as they would have shown he would not have had enough time to kill Billy Joe before going to the DIY store. The defense also suggested that Lois had lied to the police by saying that the girls' accounts had drastically changed and they could no longer be called to give evidence, adding that she was worried that the statements from their daughters could prove his innocence, meaning he could have returned home. The defense said that the girls' accounts had not changed at all, and had they been allowed to testify at the first trial, he might not have been convicted. During the appeal, Charlotte didn't suggest that what her mother had attributed to her was incorrect. The appeal judges believed Lois's account and dismissed the idea that the defense had been misled. The appeal also looked at new scientific evidence that suggested that the blood could have got onto his clothes as he bent down to check her breathing or hold her. The defense turned to Professor David Dennison, who was a leading expert in lung disease. He found what he said was evidence of PIE, or pulmonary interstitial emphysema, a rare condition. He said that there had been a buildup of pressure in her lungs in the minutes leading up to the murder. He believed that the cause of this was blood blocking her airway, and some of this was released when Sean moved her, thus the blood spots spraying onto him. "My experiments show that you can generate from the mouth and nose the sort of spatters that were found on Sean Jenkins' clothing, and the distribution is almost identical. The size of the droplets is almost identical. So it is a very, very credible explanation," Professor Dennison said. On the back of this evidence, on the 16th of June, three Court of Appeal judges quashed Sean Jenkins' original conviction, deemed it unsafe, and ordered a retrial. He was released on bail with the conditions that he live with his father in Wales and not leave a 10-mile zone unless it was to visit his lawyers or go to court. While he waited to go on trial again, in February 2005, Sean remarried. A woman called Christina had written him a letter of support in July 2004, and a relationship later formed. In April 2005, the retrial began at the Old Bailey. Prosecutor Nicholas Hilliard said that the prosecution didn't believe the account Sean had given about finding Billie Jo. Sean had allegedly said to the police that when he found her, with lots of blood around her head, he knew what happened wasn't an accident. He said he felt uneasy to let them, his two daughters, out of my sight, and went into the hall to call an ambulance. The prosecutor said, "We do not accept he was giving a truthful account. He was trying to avoid doing anything to help her." The prosecution also said that the night before, Lois and Sean had got into an argument about Billie Jo, a child that Sean would describe to the police as difficult. Lois appeared at the retrial via a video link. She cried as she said that one of their daughters had said that Sean kept going over her story with her as she was trying to read a book. She cried and said, "I feel I'm breaching the confidence of my children." She added that all the girls had moments when they opened up and spoke about the whole story, before closing up again. She explained that following the press conference, she began to suspect him. A statement that she had made in July 2003 to the police was read out, and it said the following: 3 or 4 days following the murder and in the middle of the night, it began to dawn on me that Sean was, quite possibly, responsible for the murder. I think these thoughts may have resulted from the way Sean handled the press conference during the day. I cannot remember the press conference. Following this, I have become completely paranoid about my thoughts and the implications on the girls and I. Lois said that Sean had applied for the role of head teacher, and whilst he had been told he had secured the post, he was still waiting for written confirmation, as they were checking his references. Knowing that he had lied on his CV and exaggerated his qualifications and lied about where he had got them from was making him incredibly anxious. The night before the murder, she said that Sean was pacing up and down in the lounge really fast and said that he appeared to be on edge. One of the people to testify at the retrial was Denise Lancaster, the friend that Sean had called to help Billie Jo. She said, "I could see Billie lying down on the floor with her head to one side and her hand was up near her face. The rest of her body was flat to the ground. Her legs were together in a very strange position, I felt. She looked as if she was asleep. I bent down and touched her hand and touched her cheek. I had an overwhelming sense of it not being something I could do, to put her in a recovery position, which had been my general idea. She seemed too injured for me to really touch." After telling Sean to ring for an ambulance and getting a towel for Billie Jo's wounds, she returned to the patio. "I looked more closely and saw her head was completely shattered. It was devastating. The only thing moving was the blood flowing from her nose. It was a slow trickle. The right side of her face was remarkably undamaged." Denise told the court that Sean had been wearing the blue fleece that day and that he had later left it at her house when the family had gone over. "I picked up the fleece and Lois said to Sean, 'Your coat.' He said he didn't want it and she said, 'It's freezing out there, take your coat.' Denise then said she had been with Lois when the police told her about the blood spots on his clothes. She said to me, 'Why did Sean kill Billie? If he was ever going to kill anyone, I am sure he would kill me.'" One issue that needed to be addressed was motive. During his cross-examination, it was put forward that he had killed her after she had failed to turn the music down. "You attacked her in a terrible temper in a matter of seconds," the prosecutor said. "No, I didn't attack Billie. I didn't pick up the tent peg. There was no argument whatsoever. When you left Billie, she was almost dead, wasn't she?" "No, Billie was not dead. Billie was alive and Billie was well." The court heard that Sean had what was called a peculiar look on his face as he rushed down the steps of the house and told Charlotte and Annie to get into the car. As part of the proceedings, the jury visited the house on Lower Park Road and then did the route that Sean drove that day to the DIY shop, the route that looped around the park, the route that seemed needlessly long. Throughout the retrial, the forensic evidence that had been presented during Sean's first trial was heavily scrutinised. Experts in forensics told the court that it was possible for the blood spots to get onto his clothes as he held her while she lay dying. A key witness at the retrial, Robert Schroeter, an emeritus professor at Imperial College London, would talk about the traces of other things in the blood spatter, like metal and bone. He said, "Whatever blood came out of Billie Jo's mouth would have been contaminated. So to find microscopic traces of paint or bone or metal does not change anything. The paint and metal could have come in blood running down her head into her mouth. The truth is that the scientific evidence is minimal, and the idea that Mr. Jenkins could have done what was alleged in the time he had and then gone straight out with his daughters in the car is hard to believe. The retrial would last for 3 months, and it was soon time for the jury to deliberate. Media interest was at a fever pitch. Then came the breaking news. They had failed to reach a verdict. They were discharged, and a second retrial was ordered. Before the second retrial, Dr. Skepper, who had examined the blood spots during the first trial, said that fragments of metal, paint and bone could also be present in the blood spots. But the judge ruled it inadmissible as it was submitted too late. A senior prosecution source said this evidence about the bone in the blood was completely new, and we are extremely disappointed that it did not go before the jury. When preparing for the second retrial, something new and very interesting would come out. Sean Jenkins had said that he had seen a man dressed smartly in the hallway of the family home when the ambulance arrived. It was someone he assumed was a police officer. He said, "I have stood face to face with him. I have spoken with him. I know what he looks like and I remember his mannerisms. He wore a dark navy or possibly dark olive overcoat and was smartly dressed. I could see he was wearing a tie. He had highly polished shoes. It was this fact that reassured me he was a police officer. The man was standing in the hall. I turned around and looked at him. He said, 'She's going to be okay.' Then left me staring at the door to the dining room. I honestly believe this man is responsible for my daughter's murder. I believe he killed her in cold blood for reasons that I can only speculate and surmise." He said that he believed this man had been hiding in the dining room before coming out into the hallway. Denise Lancaster, who went round after Sean called for her help, said that she thought this mystery man was a fiction. When asked in an interview why this hadn't been mentioned before, he said, "I did mention him in my original witness statement. For years, the police didn't challenge this, the idea that this man was a police officer, and for years, Sean said he believed this to be true." In 2005, when preparing for his second trial, Sean asked the CPS for the statements of all of the officers who had been to the house that day. There was only one that could not be accounted for, the man from the hallway. In spite of this new development, the second retrial of Sean Jenkins began on the 31st of October, 2005. The prosecution laid out their case again. They said that the person who had murdered Billy Joe Jenkins was not the mystery man in the hallway. They said it was Sean. It does not take a moment to hit someone with an iron bar, and not many more to hit them several forceful blows. If she did not die instantly, she could not have lived more than a few minutes. It's a mercy she was unconscious, the prosecution said. He added that Sean's story had been inconsistent as to whether or not he had actually gone into the house before going to the DIY store or not. During these proceedings, Sean admitted to being physical with Billie Joe, slapping her in the face on one occasion. He said, "I heard a noise upstairs, so I went up, and Billie was pulling heads off dolls. His daughter Esther was upset and asked her to stop, and Billie Joe swore at her and pulled her hair. I prized one of Billy's hands off Esther's hair and then slapped her face," adding that it wasn't hard, but he did regret it. He described the second occasion as being when Lois was talking to Billy Joe and Billy Joe refused to look at her. He said, "I turned Billy's face gently towards Lois and said, 'Look at your mother.'" He denied that he had kicked Billy Joe's sprained ankle during a holiday in France in the year before her murder, but a family friend, Peter Gamester, told the court that Sean definitely did. He said that he had been annoyed that she had hurt herself, allegedly saying to her, "You are always hurting yourself when I go away, every time there is something wrong." Peter added, "There is no such thing as a playful kick. It was a proper, aggressive kick." He was furious. He was angry. Videos of interviews with Billie Joe's friends taken shortly after her murder were played to the court, where they said that Billie Joe had told them that Sean had been violent towards her. One of her friends, Laura, said that Billie Joe had come into school with blood on her face, saying she got punched in her nose by her dad. There was blood on her shirt and blood around her mouth. She said on a separate occasion that Billie Joe had bruises on her arms and legs and reportedly said, "You can guess what happened." Her friend Holly spoke of another occasion in which Billie Joe had told Sean to leave their dog, Buster, alone. She said, "He pinned her up against the door and scratched her face. she said Sean just lost his temper. Her friend said that Billie Jo had been worried that if she made a complaint, her foster parents would lose their jobs. The shocking allegations did not stop there. It was stated that Lois had told police back then that one of their daughters felt Sean preferred Billie Jo to her, and that Billie Jo, quote, flirted with him. Lois would later say, "I don't recall her saying it in that situation, but there was a whole guilty thing, and that was a part of it. But I don't recall her telling me that specifically." The prosecution characterised Sean Jenkins as a bully, someone who lied repeatedly and murdered Billie Jo in a fit of rage. The defence hit back and said that Sean was a caring man who was the victim of poor forensic evidence and very bad luck. After deliberating for 39 hours over 8 days, the jury, once again, failed to reach a verdict. The prosecution agreed that it would not call for a third retrial, and the judge recorded the verdict as not guilty on the 9th of February 2006. Sean Jenkins was formally acquitted of murder. Lois's testimony about domestic abuse was only revealed after his acquittal and a court order was lifted. This testimony was not presented to any of the three juries, from his first trial and his two retrials. In spite of changes being made to the law in 2003 to allow the admission of evidence of a defendant's character to be presented, Lois had also made a claim that Sean had had a sexual relationship with a teenage girl who allegedly bore a striking resemblance to Billie Jo. This was ruled as inadmissible. Even though Billie Jo's biological father, Bill, was battling throat cancer, he had attended all the proceedings, and after Sean was formally acquitted, he spoke on radio and said that the allegations of domestic abuse against Sean should have been heard. He said, "I do feel regrets. I should have been a better father. Obviously, I'm not proud of the things I've done in my past. I feel if I'd been a better father, then perhaps Billie Jo may still be alive today. But I'm not holding myself to what happened to my daughter. There's only one person I hold responsible." Sadly, Bill would pass away a few months later. Sean Jenkins was now a free man. As he sat outside court following his acquittal, two women came up to him and began punching him and kicking him, later revealed to be Billie Jo's aunts. One of them said they would launch a civil case against Sean, as the judge had refused to allow the scientific evidence that the blood spots on his clothes contained fragments of Billie Jo's bone. She said, "We will see him again in court. This is not the end." Outside the Old Bailey stood Sean Jenkins. Billie Jo's murderer has escaped detection because of the dreadful errors in the police investigation and their single-minded and desperate determination to convict me at all costs. The police who have been in charge of the inquiry have been willfully blind and incompetent. The investigation was enormous, with many lines of inquiry and 700 statements being taken by the police. Across the three trials of Sean Jenkins, the jury spent 36 days deliberating, and it was now all over. Assistant Chief Constable Jeff Williams said Sussex Police would now take time to reflect on today's outcome. "Throughout this long and detailed investigation, we have resolutely pursued our aim, which is to seek justice for Billie Jo. The role of the police is to investigate crime, and that is what Sussex Police have done. This remains an unsolved murder case. It will, as a matter of course, be subject to review, which we will conduct with an open mind. She was brutally murdered on the patio of her foster parents' home, a place where she ought to have been safe." Following his acquittal, Sean was interviewed by journalist Trevor MacDonald as part of a special report called Billie Jo and Me. The interview covered a wide range of topics, including why had he lied on his CV and exaggerated his qualifications. He said it was simply because he'd wanted a better job and had been struggling to pay the mortgage, so wanted a job with a better salary. He explained the reasons why he had driven that particular route to the DIY shop was because it was not safe for him to turn around in the street. And shortly after setting off, he decided to go back home. But when one of his daughters expressed disappointment at not being able to paint, he drove off again to the DIY shop. He talked about the allegations that had been made by Lois. He denied being abusive and emphatically stated he had never beaten his wife. He said that Lois was vulnerable, didn't know what she was doing, and was persuaded by the police that he had killed Billie Jo. He also denied being violent with his children. Following the interview, two of his daughters said in a statement, "The comments made by our father, where he denied using corporal punishment against us, are not true." Following his experiences, Sean pursued a master's in criminology and criminal justice, and a master's in social research and methodology. He said, "I'm in my final year of my doctorate, and I'm enjoying understanding more and more about my case and what happened to me. I want to be able to use what I have learned to help other people who go through the miscarriage of justice experience." He also published a book called The Murder of Billy Joe, in which he talks about the case and his life. In the book, he spoke about this mystery man that he said he saw in the house and mistook for a police officer. And after it was published, a former neighbour said that she had remembered a report in a local newspaper that referred to a passing motorist who had seen an unidentified man coming out of the house that day. But this, like all other lines of inquiry, has seemingly gone nowhere. Sean later said that since his arrest, he had seen his daughters for a total of 2 hours whilst he was in prison in 1998 and had not seen them since, but said he hopes to reunite with them one day. He sought damages following his conviction being quashed for both wrongful arrest and imprisonment. This was denied, and a spokesperson for the Ministry of Justice said, "The right test to adopt in deciding whether someone is entitled to compensation is whether they have been shown to be innocent." The widow of Billy Joe's father said she was pleased it had been refused. "Myself and the family think he had a cheek to put in for that money. I was pleased he didn't get it, because I don't think he should be a free man. As far as I'm concerned, he should still be inside, but he has just denied it all the time." She added that Billy Joe's father would be delighted that he was turned down, because he felt in his heart that he didn't have any doubt about who did it. Following his acquittal, one person whose testimony had not been heard came forward and gave an interview. Lois Jenkins. Lois said that Sean was a physically abusive liar. "I can recall with clarity the look in his eyes as he told the children, 'Billy's dead.' It had no trace of emotion. I woke up in the middle of the night as he turned over in bed and it dawned on me, it could have been him. I lay there terrified thinking it must be him, and if it wasn't him, at least it could have been him." She added that in the days that followed, it was as if Sean wasn't there. "He offered no comfort. I felt let down and also faintly embarrassed. I wondered if our friends had noticed his detachment." Lois said that she had left the UK as a result of her foster daughter's murder, and her faith in the justice system had been tested. She said that her self-confidence had been destroyed and that she felt guilty. When speaking about Billy Joe, she said, "I grew to love her and regard her as my own daughter. She had a good rapport with Sean, and I truly believe that she was happy with her new family." As the 20th anniversary of her death was approaching, her biological mother Deborah said it would be great if they could open the investigation again and get some fresh eyes on it. "The police have nothing to lose and everything to gain. I can't describe it to you. Unless you have lost a child, it's a nightmare. I want to get justice for her." But sadly, Deborah would not see justice for Billy Joe, as she would pass away in 2018. When looking at other lines of inquiry, her family called for the police to reopen the case and look at the possibility of her murderer being a man called Anthony Emyala, dubbed the M25 rapist. Anthony Emyala was given 7 life sentences for a series of brutal sexual assaults around the M25 area. At the time of the murder, he was living in the same area as Billy Joe. Her aunt said that he fit the description of the man who was allegedly stalking her in the months leading up to her death. She said the investigation needs to be reopened for Billy Joe's sake. The police must find out what Emyala was doing on the day she was murdered. "Somebody murdered Billy Joe and we've got to find out who it was. The police need to investigate all avenues. Emyala could have done it and the fact is we don't know and need to know. Was he in Hastings that day? He was also reportedly obsessed with girls that were her age and would use improvised weapons in his attacks." Anthony Emyala died in prison on the 8th of March 2018. There are no reports of him being named as a suspect in her death, nor of him ever being investigated for it. The murder of Billy Joe Jenkins is one of the most notorious unsolved crimes in Britain. Her case has been the subject of much rumour, speculation and gossip. It's been covered in books, documentaries and on television shows. But we are still no closer to getting justice for her. Without a doubt, it is an incredibly complex investigation, both scientifically and otherwise, and there are still so many unanswered questions. For those left behind, the pain is still raw all of these years later. For Billy Joe's best friend Holly, losing Billy Joe still haunts her. I was in total shock. I was in counselling for ages. It was such a dreadful thing to happen. She was my best friend. We did everything together. We were inseparable. I wish I could have seen Billy Joe get married and have kids. She's missed out on all that. It's so, so sad. A memorial for Billy Joe Jenkins was unveiled in Alexandra Park, a wooden bench designed to be a spot for teenagers to spend time together. It was removed in 2024 due to the wood starting to rot, so hopefully it will soon be back in the park. Detective Inspector Kevin Moore said, "We owe it to Billy Joe to keep the case in the public's mind and not give up. Her case will be reviewed every 2 years in the hopes of uncovering something new. She was someone who had everything to live for. She was bright, she was funny, she was articulate, and she was someone who without a doubt would have taken on everything that life had to offer her. But due to the violence inflicted upon her on that sunny Saturday afternoon, she will be forever 13. If you have any information relating to the murder of Billy Joe Jenkins, please contact Sussex Police on 101 and quote Operation Cathedral." If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in today's case, we have left links to further resources in the description box below.